Ubhate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Namam Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakta Vedanta Swami Nityanamane Shad Ratan Viras Tavadvir Yugapat Pratak Vispurja Ruchiram Chapam Sarvan Hidyadya Sayakai Karna din shabatan viras. Savad vir yuga patratak. Vispurja ruchiram chapam. Sarvan vidyada sayakai. Karna din shabatan viras. Tavat vir yuga patpratak. Purja, twanging, rukshiram, attractive, chapam, his bow, sarvan, all of them, vivyada, he pierced, sayakai, with his arrows, karnadin, karna and the others, shut, six, ratan, chariots, Vira, the hero Samba, Tavadvi, with as many, Yugapat, simultaneously, Pratak, each individually. Translation, twanging his wonderful bow, heroic Samba, struck with arrows the six warriors headed by Karna. He pierced the six chariots with as many arrows, each team of four horses with four arrows, and each chariot driver with a single arrow, and he similarly struck the great bowman who commanded the chariots. The enemy warriors congratulated Samba for this display of prowess. Purport, Srila Prabhupada comments, while Samba was so diligently fighting along with the six great warriors, they all appreciated the inconceivable potency of the boy. Even in the midst of fighting, they admitted frankly this boy Samba was wonderful. Text 11. But they forced him down from his chariot, and thereupon four of them struck his four horses. One of them struck down his chariot driver, and another broke his bow. Having deprived Samba of his chariot during the fight, the Kuru warriors tied him up with great difficulty and then returned victorious to their city, taking the young boy and their princess. O king, when the Yadavas heard news of this from Sri Narada, they became angry, urged on by King Ugrasena, they prepared for war against the Kurus. Purport, Srila Prabhupada writes, the great sage Narada immediately carried the news to the Yadu dynasty that Samba was arrested and told them the whole story. The members of the Yadu dynasty became very angry at Samba's being arrested improperly so by six warriors. Now, with permission of the head of the Yadu dynasty's king, Ugrasena, they prepared to attack the capital city of the Kuru dynasty. Text 12. Lord Balaram, however, cooled the tempers of the Vrishni heroes who had already put on their armor. He, who purifies the age of coral, did not want a quarrel between the Kurus and the Vrishnis. And thus, accompanied by brahmanas and family elders, he went to Hastinapur on his chariot, which was as effulgent as the sun. As he went, he appeared like the moon surrounded by ruling planets. Upon arriving at Hastinapur, Lord Balaram remained in a garden outside the city and sent Uddhava ahead to probe King Dhritarashtra's intentions. Purport, Srila Prabhupada writes, when Lord Balaram reached the precincts of the city of Hastinapur, he did not enter but stationed himself in a camp outside the city in a small garden house. Then he asked Uddhava to to see the leaders of the Kuru dynasty and inquire from them whether they wanted to fight with the Yadu dynasty or to make a settlement. After he had offered proper respects to the son of Ambika, Dhritarashtra, and to Bhishma, Drona, Balika, and Duryodhana, Uddhava informed them that Lord Balaram had arrived. Purport, Śrīla Viṣṇu Chakravarti points out that there is no reference here to Uddhava offering respects to Yudhisthira and his associates, since at that time the Pandavas were staying in Indraprastha. Overjoyed to hear that Balaram, their dearmost friend, had come, they first honored Uddhava and then went forth to meet the Lord carrying auspicious offerings in their hands. Purport, in Krishna, Srila Prabhupada writes, the leaders of the Kuru dynasty, especially Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana, were very joyful because they knew very well that Lord Balaram was a great well-wisher of their family. There were no bounds to their joy on hearing the news, and so immediately they welcomed Uddhava. In order to properly receive Lord Balaram, they all took in their hands auspicious paraphernalia for his reception and went to see him outside the city door. They approached Lord Balaram and worshipped him with gifts of cows and argya, as was fitting. Those among the Kurus who understood his true power bowed down to him, touching their heads to the ground. Purport, the Acharyas explained that even the elders like Bhishmadeva also bowed down to Lord Baladev. After both parties had heard that their relatives were doing well and both had inquired into each other's welfare and health, Lord Balaram forthrightly spoke to the Kurus as follows. Srila Prabhupada writes, they all exchanged words of reception by asking one another of their welfare. When such formalities was finished, Lord Balaram in a great voice and very patiently submitted before them the following words for their consideration. Lord Balaram said, King Ugrasena is our master and ruler of kings. With undivided attention you should hear what he has ordered you to do, and then you should do it at once. King Ugrasena said, even though by irreligious means several of you defeated a single opponent who followed the religious codes, still I am tolerating this for the sake of unity between family members. Upon hearing these words of Lord Baladev, which were full of potency, courage, and strength, and were appropriate to his transcendental power, the Kauravas became furious and spoke as follows. The Kuru nobles said, oh, how amazing this is! The force of time is indeed insurmountable. A lowly shoe now wants to climb on the head that wears the royal crown. Purport, by the words Kala Gatya Dharatyaya, insurmountable movement of time, the intolerable Kurus allude to the degraded age of Kali, which was about to begin. Here the Kurus indicate that the fallen age of Kali had indeed already begun, since they claim that now the shoe wants to climb on the head that bears the royal crown. In other words, they thought that the lowly Yadus now wanted to rise above the royal Kurus. So this is one of the later pastimes in the Bhagavatam. After Krishna had gone to Dwarka, and this is the story of how Balaram dragged Hastinapur because he became angry that the Kurus were not cooperating and giving back Samba. So the cause of all of this was that Samba abducted Lakshmana, the daughter of Duryodhana, which is a normal Kshatriya practice, and then the Kurus came out and captured him, as it was explained here. He fought, and then they captured him. So then Balaram went and was negotiating peace with them, and then this is what happened. So this is a conflict between the Kurus and the Yadus. That's Krishna's family members who are from Dwarka. And Samba was the son of Jambavati. So this is one of Krishna's sons. So now we know that Krishna is Supreme Lord and everyone should obey him. And we find that the Kurus in some ways were very respectful because they respected Balaram and they offered him gifts and whatever, and they were very polite. But we see that ultimately, when it came to Balaram asking that the Kauravas give back Sambha and his bride. And then they utter these words, insulting words at Balaram. By that they show their very great pride. And also here the commentary is significant. Kala Gatya Dharataya. It is by the force of time which is impossible to overcome that we see something very remarkable happening. That is, those who have no qualities are trying to be the king. And those with the good qualities are getting insulted by these people. So they're saying that the Yadus are insulting us and we are worthy to rule. And the Yadus, including Krishna and Balaram, are useless. They're like the shoe. And they're trying to sit on the head of the Kauravas. So this is a pretty nasty comment to make to the Supreme Lord. So in other words, it is illusion. They're in great illusion. And it is ironical because they are talking about the advent of time forcing things to happen, and actually allusion to the advent of Kali Yuga. So technically speaking, Kali Yuga did not start until the disappearance of Krishna. So the moment Krishna disappeared, then Kali Yuga began. So that's the factual time when Kali Yuga started. So as long as Krishna was present, Kali Yuga did not. And after that, he entered. So in the first canto of Bhagavatam, there's a description of how after the disappearance of Krishna, when Parikshit was on the throne, then he saw Kali entering in. And of course he prevented it to some degree from happening. So Kali did not manifest very much. So what does Kali Yuga mean? Kali Yuga means more degradation. It's also explained in the first canto that there are four quarters of Dharma. We have 100% Dharma, 75% Dharma, 50% Dharma, and 25% Dharma. So Satya Yuga has 100%. And gradually that declines, and then we get 75% in Treta Yuga. That declines further. We get 50% in Dwarpa Yuga. That declines further. Then we have 25% in the beginning of Kali Yuga. That declines further until we get almost zero at the end of Kali Yuga. Then we start all over with 100% again. So there's a gradual decline of Dharma from Satya Yuga down to the end of Kali Yuga. So what does Dharma mean? Dharma means there are proper kings, proper Brahmins, proper Vaishyas, and proper Sudras, and the kings institute the rules of the Varnashram society, and they respect the Lord. So that is what Dharma is, and Dharma declines as time goes on. So after Krishna disappears, then we find very great disrespect for Dharma and proper kings and proper ruling. And instead we'll find the opposite, increase in sinful activity. That is actually described in of Lord Brahma, when after Brahma dies, then all the universes disappear. That's one big destruction. Then there's another destruction, that is the daily destruction. After Brahma does his activities for one day, then it becomes night and there's a partial destruction. Another type of destruction. Then of course we get periodic destructions within the day, and we get the destructions at the end of each Kali Yuga, 1,000 times in a day of Brahma. And we get a destruction also after 71 Yuga cycles of the Manvantaras, the 14 Manvantaras. And after each Manvantara there's a partial destruction also. And then there's the destruction of all the living energies according to their particular bodies. So human beings have 100 years and then they die, etc. So there's destruction happening on all levels at all times. So time is operating in any case. The visible one that is spoken of most in the Bhagavatam is that of the yugas, or the decline of the yugas. So the 12th canto describes how by the end of Kali Yuga nothing is left. And then some of the descendants of Manu are hiding up in the Himalayas, the Sun and the Moon dynasty. The last members are hiding up there, and then they begin Satyuga, and they populate again, and they create the dynasties again. And then it starts out with Satyuga again, and goes on like that. So there is this decline of Dharma at all times. And of course, we also know that disappears again. So it is only secondary. That's why it's secondary rasa. And it increases and intensifies that bliss in the spiritual world. And so another of those ones is anger. Sometimes Krishna becomes angry, and sometimes the gopis become angry. But it's temporary. And it all resolves into bliss again. And similarly, Krishna, he likes to fight sometimes. So this is called vira rasa. And we find this in the material world. There's some people who like to fight. Kshatriyas like to fight. So in the spiritual world, Krishna also has such a feeling. Also, he likes to fight. And even the devotees like to fight. But actually, there's no demons in the spiritual world, so it's rather difficult to express that. That fighting rasa in the spiritual world, if you don't have demons. So they fight with each other. So this is especially in the rasa of Sakya rasa. So Krishna and Balaram and the cowherd boys, they have fights with each other. But they're, of course, mock fights. Just like the children sometimes, they have wrestling matches or whatever like that. So they do that in the spiritual world also. So when they're in the playing with the cows and they play with each other, and sometimes they have wrestling matches or whatever, different types of games they play and whatever, and they compete with each other. So this is the expression of vira rasa. And through that, their sakya rasa becomes more intense, their friendship becomes more intense. So when Krishna comes to the material world, there is even greater opportunity for some of these secondary rasas to be expressed, because there are real demons in the material world. So therefore, that anger can have a real object of anger in terms of demons. There can be real fighting, and Krishna can express his vira rasa with the demons by fighting them and killing them. And same with the devotees, they can express vira rasa against the demons. But it's all related to, again, the devotees' rasas are all related to Krishna. So they fight with the demons because of Krishna. So Krishna orders Arjuna to fight. And therefore he fights on the order of Krishna, by the wish of Krishna. So everything is from Krishna ultimately. So these secondary rasas are therefore there in the material world. We say even more intense to some degree than in the spiritual world, because we have real demons to express anger and fear and this vira rasa. So that's what we see here in these different battles taking place. And we should not think that the Lord or his eternal associates and devotees are affected by material anger and material pride in all of these events. We often see that Balaram, in particular, is a little bit eccentric sometimes, and he becomes angry or he shows his pride. But this is not material again, this is an aspect of his spiritual rasa. But he can express it very intensely against the demons. And same with Krishna and the devotees also. So here we find that the Kurus are insulting Lord Balaram and the Yadu dynasty. And of course, Balaram will show great anger as a result of that. He'll become furious. Balaram is famous for his anger, and his eyes turn red. And then he'll become unmanageable, and nobody can control him at that time. So, but this is not material anger. This is the Supreme Lord, and it has a certain purpose behind it, and it's also part of the rasa of the Supreme Lord, an expression of his completeness. So we cannot criticize the Supreme Lord for this. However, the demons, yes, we can criticize them because actually they do not recognize the Supreme Lord. And when the Lord comes as avatar, this is great mercy because the Lord is not visible to people with material eyes. A spiritual form is not perceivable by material eyes. Yet the Lord appears in this material world and everyone can see Him. So that's great mercy. And it doesn't happen often. So if it happens, then everyone should appreciate that. But the demons don't. They don't recognize the Lord, instead they insult Him. So that is exemplified here where these the Kurus make such statements and insult the Supreme Lord. So this is their great misfortune. They're completely overcome by illusion. So that is an indication of influence of Kali Yuga. The Dwarpa Yuga declining, starting at 50%, going down to 25%, and then Kali Yuga starts at 25%, and that starts declining again. So here we see the premature decline of Dharma and increase of ignorance, where the Supreme Lord is there and they can't recognize Him at all. And instead they do the opposite. They insult Him. Not only they don't recognize, but they insult Him. So this is the demons. As a result of this, ultimately, the Kurus were annihilated. They all died. So this is one cause. Of course, there are many other causes why they were annihilated, but many different incidences were there to provoke their destruction. So this is one cause again, big insult. So when Krishna came, therefore, He accomplished this also. That is, a dharma was annihilated completely. So as long as Krishna was present, then dharma was intact. And then when He disappeared, it's all gone. But as I said, the main thing was Krishna appeared for giving pleasure to His great devotees. So He did that by displaying these different pastimes. So all these pastimes, including His fighting pastimes and whatever, and the anger of Balaram, these are for the pleasure of the devotees. And this way they appreciate all aspects of the Supreme Lord. So then after Krishna disappeared, then everything went back to what it was before. And all the demons increased again. And Dharma became more, 25%, and then became more and more and more. And Dharma decreased more and more. So in spite of the fact that the Lord came, then again the situation after killing all the demons again, then reverted back to its normal progress. So this is the cycle. And the Lord does not prevent it from happening. There is a Satya Yuga, a Treta Yuga, a Dwarpa Yuga, and Kali Yuga. And Krishna does not interfere with that. If Kali Yuga is supposed to come, it will come. That is also the Lord's will. So Krishna destroys a dharma, definitely, and He supports a dharma, but at the same time, it is the will of the Supreme Lord under time, that using time, that this dharma will happen again. Why? Why He'll do that? Why doesn't the Lord just stop and have every Asakya Yuga all the time? Because it is the very nature of the material world, that's why. It is the nature of the material world to destruct, to decline. Even of matter, I think we find that. It goes from high energy state to low energy state. And we find that with the universe. The universe starts up with a big bang and ends up blah. Finally, the same with the sun. The sun is there, and finally, the sun dies, like that. So they have telescopes up in the sky, and they say, "Oh, that was the dying universe up there." They gradually, first, some are being born, some universes are getting born, and then some are dying again. The same with the galaxies. So the whole universe is like that. All the universes are like that in Mahavishnu. They all come out, and they all get, flourish and everything, and then they all die again. Under the will of the Supreme Lord. So it is the will of the Lord that creation and destruction take place in this material world. And the Lord Himself will not prevent that. So Krishna came, and wiped out all the demons again, and then Kali Yuga started after and disappeared. It's not the Lord isn't powerful. No, it's the will of the Lord. Destruction will take place. Kali Yuga must take place according to the cycle. So we have destruction on all levels. So similarly, everybody must die. No one can live forever. And this is a rule. So everybody is a material body. Material body must die. So nobody's exempt. So the devatas have to give up their posts and die also after 71 yuga cycles finished. And then again, Brahma has to give up his life after billions and billions and billions of years. Finished. So this is all will of the Supreme Lord. Material bodies cannot last. Material planets cannot last. Material universes cannot last. Everything material will ultimately go to destruction. Why? Because that's the nature of matter. It's not spiritual. In the spiritual world, nothing dies. Nothing decays. Everything is eternal. So why the Lord does this, have a imperfect world? Only for education of jivas, that's all. Education of the atmas. So they'll understand material world is not a perfect place, that's all. The whole thing goes on for that reason, to show that material world is not where we belong, because we're eternal and we want eternal body. And material world cannot give us that material body, eternal body. That's the lesson we have to learn from that. So the Lord has, by his will, introduced all of this creation, destruction over and over again for that purpose. So that we have to understand. And those who are perceptive will understand that. Understanding the material world is temporary. We are subject to birth and death. We don't like this. It is not a perfect state. That is the first sign of our intelligence. Higher intelligence. All living entities have some intelligence. Animals have intelligence, plants have intelligence to some degree. And human beings have intelligence. But real intelligence starts when we get that perception. There's something wrong with this body dying. It's not a perfect position. We can't. What's something wrong here? That is the first value of our buddhi, our discriminating power. And then after that, and then we can begin other things by association, etc. Then we understand higher scriptural knowledge, etc. And then we can understand the difference between Atman and body. And then if we get associated with devotees, then we can understand the existence of the Supreme Lord behind the whole thing. So it's all under the will of the Supreme Lord, ultimately. And within that, we have the jivas subject to their own free will. And the Lord doesn't interfere with that. So it may take jivas billions and billions and billions of lifetimes to come to this even one realization: world is temporary. It'd take them a long time. Animals don't know that. No animal's aware a world is temporary, my body is temporary. They don't think about it. And most human beings don't think about it. And that is why when the Yaksha asked the question, who was actually Yamaraj, he asked Yudhisthira, "What is the most astonishing thing in the world?" Then you just said, the most astonishing thing in the world. Everybody dies, everybody sees everybody else is dying, they also know they're going to die, but at the same simultaneously think, I'm not going to die. I'm going to live forever, and they act like they're going to live forever, and they do everything in this material world, and suddenly they die. This is astonishing. Nobody thinks they're going to die. But they see everybody else die. But they think, I'm not going to die. And they go on merrily with their life, and then they die also. And suddenly they're surprised, oh, I'm dying. So this is a strange phenomenon, he says, a surprising lack of intelligence. But that is there. And even we read the scripture, and even we know, yes, material body is temporary, still we don't believe it. Because we act in the other way. And we go on living like that, and we're thinking in terms of our body and stuff like that, and then I think I'm going to live forever. And we take care of our body and spend so much time supporting ourselves and our family and this and that, whatever. It's all temporary. So it does take, of course, to accept it intelligently is one thing. That's a good step. At least we can perceive it. And then to act upon that is another thing. Seriously act upon that. That's a higher realization. To really, 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 really believe it and act upon that. That's a very needs high realization. So anyway, this is time. Time is there for that purpose, to make us realize nothing lasts forever in the material world. Okay. Any questions?
We
could say dissolution of Dharma, obviously. And generally things decline, and it's described in the 12th canto of Bhagavatam how, you know, at the end of the plants have all disappeared, the people are very small, and there's no sunlight, and it's all thundery skies with clouds and no sunlight, but no rain. So basically, it's rather destructive. It's not a productive situation at that time. Huh? And then when Satyuga comes, then it's, you know, very natural, and there's produce, and the plants are giving everything. So it's kind of a destruction also. Well, yeah, when Satya Yuga, there's a little sandhi, they call it sandhis, the joining periods between the yugas. I forget how many years it is, but anyway, there's a sandhi between each yuga. There's a Kali Yuga sandhi before Kali Yuga starts, between Dwarpa and Kali, and then between Kali and Satya, that's kind of a little interim period, so that's, I guess, the revival period.
The observations of the astronomers in, you know, observing black holes and, or, you know, imploding and exploding stars and so forth, could that somehow either be correlated with the breathing of Mahavishnu?
In one sense, it's like that, because there's a, and they say, you know, the whole creation, destruction of all the galaxies and all the universe, or whatever we call it, you know, all these things up there, is basically a repetitive cycle. It's like Mahavishnu breathing in and out. It just goes on like that eternally over billions and billions and billions of years. I don't know what the time scale for that is. I know that their theoretical dimension of the universe is 7.8 billion light years. Yeah, and one light year is 9.6 trillion kilometers. So that's the width of the universe, so to speak, which is something like, what is it, 12 plus 9 zeros, you know, something like that, 60 times. That's the width of the universe. Now, the time, I don't know exactly the time, what the theory is, anyway, in this cycle of creation, destruction. But within that, they see when they have their telescopes and the Hubble telescope and that, then they see there is, you know, some of them being born now and some of them getting destroyed, you know, right now. But those are so far away that it's light years, you know, it takes us so many light years for the that image to get to us, so it must have happened in the past sometime. It's hard to say. This is one thing our planets called planetarium researchers have to figure out, and it's a controversy too, whether, you know, we speak of the whole universe, everything and all the galaxies in it, is that part of the universe, or we think of our solar system as kind of the universal thing with that. That is the universe. So this is a controversy among things, you know, different devotees about what is what. And of course we do have the idea of the universe with the coverings on it. And we have an earth covering and water and a fire and an air and an ether and a mahatattva, a hankara and a mahatattva and a prakriti covering on it and getting bigger and bigger and bigger, so it surrounds it like a big egg. But whether that actually is, it's matter, but matter itself also is so fine that we don't really perceive it until it combines in different things called panchakarani, where all five elements combine, and then you get a real earth element, that way we know it's earth, coming out of that way they all combine. And then we have a visible element. So these elements are actually very subtle in themselves. So earth element, pure, but we don't see it. And water we don't see either. Fire, we don't see all those things, of what we speak of, akash and, you know. higher ones, Ahankara and Prakriti, are invisible to us. So even the pure gross elements are actually very subtle. So even though it's a covering, maybe we can't even see it. I don't know. It's hard to say.
So what we're seeing in the mind is actually a combination of the job.
So maybe, I don't know, and Jiva Goswami mentioned something about the Panchakarani and the thing. So maybe when it comes to Panchakarani, when he talks about earth and the fire covering, maybe it is combined at that stage. I'm not sure. I'll look it up in his commentary. It says one place like that. Yeah. But the funny thing is that how do we consolidate that with what we see here in the modern astronomy? Because they've seen that, somehow together. I don't know. But when they look in their telescopes and they see these, you know, especially when they took the Hubble telescope up, which was, I think, 1995 or something, then they took it out of the, beyond the atmosphere, and then they began to photograph the universe from there, and it's much clearer because there's no atmosphere there at all. And then they were surprised at what they saw there, because what they thought were stars were galaxies, and the galaxy had about, each galaxy has about a million stars in it, or a million, you know, suns in it. And each of these little points in the sky that we don't even see half the things up there. When they saw the sky, we may see in our, this is our Milky Way galaxy, you know, so, and there was what we call suns are there. And then from science's point of view, not from our point of science, you know, the suns are there, you know, these things. But then, actually, when they look up in the sky, and then what they saw weren't suns, they were galaxies. Which means millions of suns in one little thingy. And they expanded them, and they saw it was all galaxies there. And they went more and more, and within they counted 10,000 galaxies in a little space like this. Yeah. And each of the galaxies has so many, you know, planets and suns and whatever in it, you know. I think there's a million suns within each galaxy approximately. And within there was 10,000 galaxies in a little space like this, and found out. So you look at the whole sky, it's so many planets out there and so many things out there. It's inconceivable. And they were surprised because they didn't know that. They thought, you know, okay, there's some galaxies out there and there's other groups of suns out there. You know, there's tons of them out there. And of course, that's all they can see. And there may be more beyond that because their telescopes can only see so far. So then someone said the possibilities of life, that when we say, well, is there any other life in the universe, it sounds like a ridiculous question. Because the number of planets that may have life would be like infinite when you see the number of galaxies that are out there and somewhere, you know, spread all over the place. So that's like, you know, so many universes are there, you know, and it's like the Karna ocean, or the bubbles, and each bubble is a universe, and in the universe then we have so many planets and so many life energies like that. So they were surprised when they saw all this. And then they thought, well, there must be life somewhere, definitely. The whole thing is that it's so far away. So how do you get from one group to the other? That's the whole puzzle. How do you get from one galaxy to another? Well, they're so far away. We can't even get to any other planet in this universe without a struggle, in this solar system even, you know? Yeah. And send a probe up somewhere. How far will it go? It won't go that far. I think they sent something up as far as Jupiter. So at least they could, you know, see what's on Jupiter. They sent something up that direction. It took them 10 years to get there. So Saturn is much further away, much, much further away than that. And if you go to Neptune and Pluto, that's way out there, you know. So they go to another galaxy. Wow, that's far out. So the only way you can do that is instantaneous travel. You can't go by normal physical means. You got to go by some paranormal means. That's the only way you can do it.
Maharaj, you said earlier that all the different emotions experienced in the spiritual world just exist to like secondary rasas, exist to...
There's primary ones, the loved ones, and then we get secondary rasas like anger, fear, etc. And that increases the primary rasa.
I was just wondering if the all the suffering and ignorance that we...
It's another rasa. Oh, well, yeah, in one sense, yes, the suffering of the material there is to make, in this world, is to make you realize you can't be happy here. That the material world is not a place for bliss ultimately. In the spiritual world, that increases, that the two things go together, they're inseparable. In the material world, the idea of suffering, etc., for us here, that's completely separate from bliss. We have what is called happiness in the material world, but that's not real bliss, that's not spiritual bliss at all. So we have that duality of happiness and suffering in the material world. And neither of them are satisfying. Nobody likes the suffering, and the happiness keeps ending. So that's not satisfying either. So what we want is eternal bliss. But we don't get it. But to come to the realization that to get the eternal bliss, you're going to have to give up the material body, that takes a long time. So we go from body to body to body, and we're trying to get our happiness each lifetime, and we keep trying and trying and trying. We go for billions and billions and billions of lifetimes doing that. And suddenly, maybe we get a realization. It's useless. We can't try like this anymore. Happiness, the stress goes on, and it's useless. We know, we've done it in previous lifetimes, and it's a useless attempt. And when we come to that realization, then you're ready for spiritual life. So that's the whole purpose of the material world. Duality.
What comes with the humanity then, especially the lady, who understands the futility of material existence, yet want or can't give up the desire to enjoy it?
Oh, yeah. So we have, as I said, we can get the intelligence, we can kind of accept it. Yeah? But we still have, we're not complete. It's a partial realization. In other words, we get knowledge, but that knowledge has to go deeper and deeper and deeper. So we can accept the knowledge on an intellectual level because we do have some faith. Faith comes from the soul, but then when the intellect is accepting this, okay, it's nice, but the soul really hasn't accepted it fully. Huh? So we have two levels of realization, in the mind and the intelligence, which is material, and then in the soul itself. Now, we cannot separate the two because obviously without the soul, we won't have any intelligence at all. Nothing can operate without a consciousness. And we will accept those facts because we have faith. And the faith comes from the soul. Otherwise, we'll reject the scripture and we say, it's not true anyway. So we accept it because we have faith. But to actually act upon it, that requires deeper faith. So when we practice bhakti and we get deeper and deeper faith, then we will act upon it. Yeah. And we'll consider, we'll see everything in the material world as useless at that point. Not just intellectually we'll accept it, but we'll actually see it as useless when that faith becomes very deep.
And that removes the influence of passion.
Everything. Of course, bhakti says kleshagni, so it removes, avidya, which is the final thing, ahankara and above, and it removes desires, and it removes all karmas as well. And it removes that because bhakti produces more and more attraction to Krishna. And that attraction to Krishna is based on unconditional love, which means we're not acting for ourselves anymore. So that destroys the ignorance and everything, because our whole purpose, the whole thing about ignorance is that we're trying to be independent. Act for our own enjoyment. And if we act for Krishna's enjoyment, and we express unconditional love for Krishna, then that automatically wipes out the avidya and all the things that come from that, including the ahamkara and the desires and then the karmas. We get wiped out. Yeah. That's what we call the neophyte, Vishnu Chakravarti Saramadura Kilamadi. He's war with Maya. Sometimes Maya wins, sometimes bhakti wins. It's kind of a dual thing. Yeah? So we have attraction for material things due to our ahankara still being there. And then we have faith, so we have some attraction to Krishna. Yeah? So when it's nishta, then the majority goes for Krishna and less for Maya. And when you get to ruchi and asakti, then you have more and more and more increase of for Krishna, and less for Maya. And when you get the bhava, then Krishna says, okay, even if you've got a little contamination, okay, I'll show myself to you. And we get a real experience of Krishna at that point.
In that stage of warm with Maya, the lady sometimes wonders, you know, whether you're not being practically schizophrenic.
Yeah.
Wonders.
Yeah.
And for some of those, it seems that that's at that point they give up.
Which means that the actual material drives are stronger and the faith is very weak. If faith is strong, then automatically then they'll just, okay, Maya's there, you know, we have it, but you know, we deal with it. But if the faith is weak, then generally they'll go in the opposite direction and they, you know, leave. But even then, if they do have genuine faith, it is said that, you know, once you have a taste, it never leaves you. So it comes back the next lifetime and it can increase from there until they do get stronger and stronger faith, until they can operate properly and do bhakti properly. Whatever. What helps faith? Well, of course, association, and then the proper sadhana, etc., and the hearing and chanting and all these things. This increases the bhakti. This is what called the Nabhajana Kriya. So we go from initial faith all the way up to nishtha through Bhajana Kriya. So that's the process, and that keeps going on and higher and higher. Because the Kanishka doesn't even like devotees. You know, he only appreciates, okay, we like the Lord, we accept the Lord, but we don't want to associate with the devotees. So that's a big obstacle, because if you don't associate with the devotees, then you can't advance. No mercy.
It's more than just say,
oh yeah.
But understanding the philosophy is not enough. It's got to be, like you said, not just intellectualized, it's got to be internalized.
Oh yeah, because that's what faith is. Faith is not a not intellectual thing. Mm-hmm. That's internal, so that's the very basis of bhakti. If you don't have that and you do your bhakti, then it's not real bhakti. Because it's coming from the mind or the intellect or whatever. So when you say you start with faith and then you practice bhakti, you know, anya abhilasha, shunya, all that, that's coming from atma. That can only come from the atma, because it's spiritual. Bhakti is spiritual. It's not a material thing. Jnana is material, actually. It is sattva-guna. It's only material. That's why it's attractive to some people, because it may be a little more practical for them, because it's sattva-guna. But bhakti is actually spiritual. So you have to have that little seed of bhakti in the heart, called faith. And if that is there, then you can begin the process and then it will increase the increase. But if you don't have that there, then it'll just be all empty stuff. Mm-hmm. Intellectual knowledge.
So that's nourished by the study of the Shastra, or cultivation of Jnana, but also other.
Oh yeah. Bhakti Jnana, Bhagavad Jnana, and association, hearing, chanting, all these different things. Increase it. It's a watering process.
So I can come from deity worship.
All these processes, yeah. All the angas of bhakti.
Taking
prasadam, yeah. They all do it. But our main process is hearing and chanting and association.
That's what it looks like, Jnana is common.
Yeah. But it's Bhagavad Jnana. Because if it's just Jnana, that is in the mind only. So therefore, you have to have the faith. And then the devotion, and you accept the scriptures, you know, with faith. If it's a jnana, then it doesn't work. So the faith has to be there. Because even Bhagavatam, the jnani will look at it and he'll get a different message. That's the nature of Shastra. That's what Krishna says. I like parokshavada. Parokshavada means indirect expression. Hide the meaning. So the materialists look at one scripture, they'll see a material meaning. And the devotees look at it, they'll see another meaning. So even Bhagavatam is like that. Huh? So the impersonalists and jnanis will get jnana meaning out of it, and the bhaktas will get devotional meaning out of it. And that's explained by Vishnu Chakravarti. It's like Mohini. Mohini was very nice, and demons said, oh, she's beautiful, give her the nectar, because she's going to give us the nectar. They gave her the nectar, she gave it to the devatas. So like that Bhagavatam gives to the devotees, and it gives another thing to the demons, fools the demons. So it puts a covering over them, everything. So the people without faith hear, they hear something else. Yes.
What does that mean?
means to speak indirectly. Hide the meaning, basically. It's like esoteric, you know, this is esoteric shastra. So you know, the direct meaning is one thing and the internal meaning is something else.
Did you say Krishna likes the corruption?
That's what he says, yeah. That's very dear to me.
He has to hide the meaning of these.
Yeah.
So only the devotees will get the meaning.
Yeah. This is why he says rahasya. Bhakti is rahasya, secret. Guhyam. I teach you the highest secret.
Because he said that to Rajendra in the fourth chapter, he said, you can understand it because you're actually the devotee.
Yeah. You're my friend.
Because you're the
devotee.
Which is an interesting qualification because it's it removes everybody else.
Well, it's just like Krishna also says, you know, the demons think of me and they see me and they think I'm a material person. The devotee sees me, he understands I'm God. So Krishna reveals himself in the material world, but different people see different things. And Krishna especially makes it difficult because he acts like a normal human being. So even Brahma gets bewildered. Okay. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.